Welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grody, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great honor and privilege to come together to hear a conversion story, a story of faith and conversion. We're here with Dr. Michael Root. He's a former Lutheran and is now the Professor Emeritus of Systematic Theology at Catholic University of America. And he came into the Catholic Church in 2010, and we're just so honored to have him here tonight to share his story.
Oh,
Mike, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. I'm looking forward to digging into, again, your story, lots to cover there, but also the, you know, you were involved in the, what do we want to summarize here, the Lutheran Catholic dialogues,
right,
and the joint declaration. I know we've had a number of guests who've shared either being involved with those or being, having those, being a significant part of their story, attempt, right, to seek dialogue, seek
right,
understanding across those lines. So I'm excited to hear all that tonight.
Good.
All right. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up, and how does your story begin?
Well, I grew up in southeastern Virginia. I was born in Norfolk. Just before I started school, we moved out to Norfolk County, which was what it was then, out in the countryside. When we first moved out to, it became the city of Chesapeake. When we first moved out to the country, I don't remember, we didn't go to church much. But when I was about the fourth grade, Presbyterian church was being organized. There were a lot of school teachers involved, and my mother was a school teacher. So we started going. My mother became very active. My brothers and I were all baptized. I grew up then in the Presbyterian church in sort of rural becoming suburban section south of Norfolk, Virginia. I wouldn't say I was overly strongly devout. I certainly was a believer in a certain sense in the sort of quasi-conventional way in, say, the late 50s, early 60s. In the South, one was. Thinking about it now, the first theology book I read was John A.T. Robinson's Honest to God, which was a popular book in the 60s, a very liberal kind of theology. But I think my oldest brother's fiance had read it in college, and somehow the copy ended up around the house. You know, I was an avid reader, so I read it. And I had no knowledge of theology, sort of thinking about the faith in a serious way had never crossed my mind. I read it. I read some sermons of Paul Tillich. Again, a kind of theology I might now think is a little thin, but nevertheless, right, quite interesting.
Sure.
But as was typical of a sort of teenager in the late 60s, I read French existentialism. I think between the junior and senior year high school, I read all of Albert Camus in English. And so I became the sort of 17-year-old existentialist that girl won't go to a high school dance with you, thus the universe is absurd. The kind of way, the easy existentialism of a 17-year-old. I never gave up the faith, but it was conflicted and confused in the way that teenagers are, maybe
sure,
particularly in the late 60s. When I went off to college, by sheer chance or divine providence, I ended up in a dorm, and there were a couple of guys, upperclassmen, very impressive guys who were religion majors. There was a religion department at the school. It was very impressive. I fell in with some friends who were from Boston. They were Catholics. They were somewhat in rebellion against their upbringing. Many of them had never gone to anything but parochial schools. So we'd visit different churches in the small town where the college was. Mm. Catholic. There was no Presbyterian. Congregational, Episcopal. And I took a course actually entitled Religion 1. 10 weeks, everything from the beginnings of the Bible to post-Vatican II in 10 weeks.
Wow.
It's the sort of course people make fun of. Yeah. But it was a great course, actually.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. And I read Martin Luther's On the Freedom of a Christian, and one of his early books, texts, only about 20 pages. Enormous impression on me. And I went to a Lutheran church. I grew up in rural Virginia. There were no Lutherans, Tidewater, Virginia, where mm-hmm, I grew up. So this was all strange and new.
Yeah.
The liturgy, which is, the Lutherans had kept the basic form of the Western liturgy, was very impressive. A Lutheran understanding of justification by grace through faith meant a great deal to me at that age. It fit in with a sort of loose existentialism that I had sort of been attracted to as a 17-year-old. And theology quite got a grip on me.
Hmm.
It was, I'm going to say, so I never had left the faith, but I would say it became far more serious to me, although I have to say in a really heady way. This is,
sure,
this will be the story of my life, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I live between my ears more than I should. But theology gripped me.
Right.
And I became active in the Lutheran student ministry, became a Lutheran then. And went off to graduate school in theology. This is what I really love doing. And I went to Yale for grad school. And at the time, in American Protestant theology, of the grad schools, there was sort of a polarization of the more liberal Chicago and the more conservative Yale, where the influence of Karl Barth, who was maybe the greatest Protestant theologian of the 20th century, and far more doctrinally serious and traditional, was really the dominant kind of school at Yale, which I really would shape me. I moved, I would say, in a more significantly more traditional doctrinal direction. And the other thing that really helped shape my faith and career at the time was working with one of my professors, George Lindbeck, who was really active in the Lutheran Catholic dialogue internationally. He'd been an observer at Vatican II. He was on the U.S. Lutheran Catholic dialogue, the international Lutheran Catholic dialogue. And I took courses with him, which I read these texts. And it wasn't so much the unity of the church that gripped me. What gripped me was that I found in the dialogues with the Catholic Church a richer kind of Lutheranism, a Lutheranism that was in touch with the wider Catholic tradition, which meant a great deal to me. There is, and I think this is one thing that ended up disturbing me, a kind of tension within Lutheranism between a more open to the Catholic tradition approach and a more, whatever you might call it, strictly Protestant approach.
Right.
And I was always attracted, I became strongly attracted in college, in graduate school, to a more Catholic understanding of Lutheranism, what would be called evangelical Catholicism and an evangelical Catholic Lutheranism. And that's what really shaped me. And so I finished grad school. No, I was not a pastor. I never felt called to the ministry. I thought about it. My mother told me not to be a pastor. I loved humanity, but there weren't many people I liked, perhaps. But I ended up teaching at a seminary, which I really wanted to do. Theology, I think, exists for the service of the church. And so when an opportunity to teach at a seminary opened up, and I was offered a position at the Lutheran Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina, my own part of the country, I certainly identify as a Southerner fairly strongly, I was happy to do it. So I was teaching theology at a small Lutheran seminary, South Carolina. But I got involved in ecumenical work.
I was going to ask you, because leading into that ecumenical work, you know, up to this point, you know, you've gotten a taste of not just Lutheran theology, but sort of the camps within it and the different persuasions.
Right.
You know, up to this point, like, what is your sense of the unity or the disunity of the church? How did you understand it at the time?
I think I had a kind of standard Lutheran view without having thought about it all that clearly, let me say, at that age. That what mattered was the unity in the preaching of the word and the administration of the sacraments. There's a famous line in the fourth article of the Augsburg Confession: it is sufficient for the unity of the church to agree upon the preaching of the word and the evangelical administration of the sacraments. Now, that phrase in the fourth article of the, fifth article, in the Augsburg Confession, that article, its context and its historical meaning is a complicated question. But there's a sense in which it's not invisible. I mean, the preaching of the word and the administration of the sacraments are visible, but it's not administrative or governmental. So what mattered was sort of, and often this was reduced to, what really matters is an agreement in doctrine. Everything else doesn't quite matter. And an agreement on practice, particularly about the administration of the Lord's Supper, of the Eucharist. I didn't really have a particularly clear understanding, I would say, at that point, of my life. But I became engaged, involved in ecumenical work. I was on the Governing Council of the Lutheran Church in America. I was on the Ecumenical Relations Committee. There were a lot of things going on. I was on the Lutheran Methodist Dialogue. This was taking more and more of my time. And an opportunity opened up to go to the Institute for Ecumenical Research in Strasbourg, France, which is The Ecumenical Institute of the Lutheran World Federation, the organization of most of the Lutheran churches in the world. The one big exception is the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in this country. Mm-hmm. And you just worked on ecumenical questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was, in some sense, the professor's dream institution. Professors, no students, and no deans.
Yeah.
And you just did research for the ecumenical dialogues, to some degree on sort of Lutheran confessional questions for Lutheran churches. And you lived in Strasbourg, France, which is a wonderful place. So in 1988, I went there. And my work at first was Lutheran Anglican. But now that also raised questions which were not irrelevant to relations with the Catholic Church, in that the issue at the time was whether Lutheran churches were willing, in the context of entering full communion with Anglicans, mm-hmm. to accept episcopal succession.
Mm-hmm.
Apostolic succession, the notion of a succession of bishops going back in time.
Right.
Now, it wouldn't have been one that the Catholic Church would recognize, but mm-hmm. The principle was involved in relation with Anglicans. And this was quite controversial.
Right.
Now, at the same time, there was a situation with the Catholics in relation with justification by grace through faith. The American dialogue, the German dialogue, and the international dialogue had all agreed there is significant agreement here. Perhaps agreement enough to say, in and of itself, this issue is not church dividing.
Mm.
But the dialogues are just professors talking. They yeah. carry no authority. It was at the point in the early 90s of saying, is there some way the churches could affirm this consensus? Could the churches would say officially, yes, this isn't just professors talking. We think this is correct. So there was a move toward some kind of making this official. And with the Catholics, that had to occur at the international level. Doctrine is a Vatican question.
Right.
A certain problem with the Lutherans, it's the national churches that do this. So the Lutheran World Federation set up a coordinating body. But the dialogue texts are these long, 80, 90-page texts. We needed something shorter. So there needed to be a short summary written. And so there was a committee to do it. But a problem was that the committee was writing in German. And neither the ecumenical head of the Vatican Ecumenical Office nor the Secretary General of the Lutheran World Federation read German. So they needed an English version done immediately and by somebody who was an insider who would get it right. So they put on an American Catholic and an American Lutheran to participate in the drafting and simultaneously produce an English version. I was the American Lutheran to produce an English version. So I got pulled into the Lutheran Catholic dialogue while also doing work with the Lutheran Anglicans. That was the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification.
Gotcha.
Some of the most intensive work in my life, because we would work all day on the draft,
mm-hmm.
and then there'd be dinner, and some other people would have wine or stuff after dinner, and Jared Wicks and I had to go work on the English translation, which was a success. We can talk later about what it does and doesn't mean.
Right.
But the Lutherans and the Catholics agreed
mm-hmm.
that in terms of what they were willing to say they stood for in this text, then the condemnations of the past don't apply. Not that the condemnations don't condemn something that's worth condemning, but they don't condemn what is now being taught.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of the agreement. And after a great deal of very vigorous discussion, particularly in Germany, that was affirmed in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, in the United States, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, of which I was a member, and the Episcopal Church was having this debate over full communion and whether the ELCA was willing to adopt Episcopal succession. And again, this was a very, very vehement, intense argument.
Mm-hmm.
It needed a two-thirds majority to pass the assembly, and in 1997 it failed by 6 votes, 66.1%. There was a redo, it came up again in 1999, and it was accepted. So I was involved in the 1990s in these intense internal Lutheran ecumenical arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And in a certain sense, the evangelical Catholic side I was on won, if you're going to put it that way.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, at the end of that process, I was shaken a bit. I was convinced that the kind of Lutheranism the evangelical Catholic Lutheranism to which I was committed was firmly rooted in one side of the Lutheran tradition. But if I was being honest with myself, and sometimes I was, the other side of the Lutheran tradition, the radical Lutherans, as they would sometimes call themselves, they also had some basis in the tradition. The tradition was internally ambiguous. It could be read in significantly different ways. And the question that sat in my mind was that it seemed to me that the Lutheran tradition had neither the conceptual nor the institutional resources to settle this internal ambiguity, which goes back to the very beginning, when Luther, after Luther was condemned at the Diet of Worms in 1521, he went into hiding for a year, and there were significant disturbances in Wittenberg, arguments back and forth, and Luther finally had to come down and sort of settle the issue. But there were a kind of internal ambiguity of Lutheranism. Is it a reform movement in the Church Catholic, the way evangelical Catholics wanted to say, so that the point of Lutheranism was to engage with the wider Catholic tradition? Or was it the rediscovery of the gospel, purely and simple, and the Catholic tradition is just wrong and you reject it? This ambiguity, I think, runs very deep. Yeah. And I think by 2000, 2001, I still was the kind of Lutheran convictions I had were still there. But I wondered about how secure the foundations were, you might say,
right,
and the inherent difficulties and ambiguity in the tradition.
Yeah,
I would say a decisive change. And if people ask me when did you start moving in a Catholic direction, mm-hmm, was one of these events of providence, so to speak, or sheer luck, mm-hmm, whatever you want to call it. A friend of mine, Fritz Bauerschmidt, teaches at Loyola, Maryland, was editing a issue of Modern Theology journal, and it was going to be Aquinas in Dialogue. And so, well, we'll get Root to write the Aquinas in Protestantism article. That'll work. He does that sort of thing. So I said I would, and I thought I'd use the opportunity to try and understand something in Aquinas that as a Lutheran I just couldn't understand, and that had come up in the Joint Declaration, because it's also Trent, same
right
thing.
Yeah.
Aquinas says, this is the end of the second part of the Summa, very last question. Question 114, on merit. He says, on the one hand, no one ever merits being justified. Justification is never merited, nor if you fall from grace, you never merit a return, nor do you merit the gift of perseverance. That you enter, return to, or stay in a state of grace is always pure gift. But we will merit eternal life on the last day.
Yeah.
To a Lutheran, well, I mean, either you merit the whole thing or you don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you have this understanding that you merit eternal life in the end, but along the way you don't merit justification? This just struck me as strange. So, you know, I'll work on this. I'll try and understand it.
Right.
What I came to see was something I think quite important. That we're justified by grace is part of the standard Augustinian tradition of the Western Church. The question is, how does grace engage us as responsible human beings, as beings with freedom, who are then accountable for what we do?
Right.
What Aquinas, and more broadly the Catholic tradition, I came to understand, argues, is that yes, that you are in a state of grace, that you are in that movement toward eternal life. That's pure gift. You have nothing to boast of. All you do is thank God.
Right.
But within that process, grace engages you, doesn't engage you like a rock or a stone. You aren't just moved like one picks up something and moves mm-hmm. it. You are moved as a free human being. Grace can operate within us. It isn't, and that in that process, it's both a gift, but it's a gift which engages our action so that one can say, I do X and I merit Y. So that within the process of the Christian life, one can merit
right.
things from God. And we trust that grace is so great that come the last day, come when we face judgment, mm-hmm. grace will have worked it in such a way that God can say, welcome, good and faithful servant.
You know, I'm curious about that because it's always struck me that there's a connection between these nuanced questions of grace and justification and merit, and the fact that God reveals himself as Father. In other words, this is, God doesn't have to work this way, but he wants to raise us up.
Right. Yeah. It's precisely, there's a very nice line in C.S. Lewis about, now this is actually about purgatory in a certain sense, mm-hmm. but it fits into the same total picture of the person who comes in, you know, I've been working all day, I'm all sweaty, but sit down to dinner. No, I'd rather go take a shower. You'd want to get purified in a certain sense. In the same way that grace is so great, that grace engages us so we can say that in grace we will merit.
Right.
Now, you only merit in Christ. It's the branch and the vine. Mm-hmm. But so that the insistence on we will merit, and the New Testament is full of reward language.
Right.
The insistent isn't a compromise of grace. It's seeing how great grace is.
Right.
And that's what I came to see mm-hmm. when I wrote an article, it's 2004, on this issue on Aquinas and Dialogue of Modern Theology. And I would never have done it probably unless I had been asked to do this. And it struck me at the time. Now, at the time, I thought, gee, that's interesting. I mean, and I was, at the time I was in, you know, there are the ways these ideas can be appropriated within the Lutheran framework to which I was pretty strongly committed. And over the next years, I thought about it. It wasn't a major research project of mine. I was working on some other things. But every time I came back to it, I was a little more convinced.
Yeah.
And by the end of the decade, you know, it was really growing stronger. And I have to admit, whereas if somebody would ask me, why did you become a Catholic? Mm-hmm. The reason really had to do with being basically shifted in my understanding of grace. And this issue about God engaging our freedom, mm-hmm. our responsibility, our being agents, makes a wide difference in a whole series of how you understand things. I mean, there's a certain strain of Lutheranism that the Lord's Supper is pure gift. The directionality is all from God to us. But is it also the case that that gift engages us so that we offer back to God, that we are taken into Jesus' self-offering so that the Mass is a sacrifice?
Right.
We are offering Christ because we are in Christ. Mm-hmm. So that our self-offering is taken into Christ's offering and we offer Christ in the Mass. So that you get a doctrine of the sacrifice of the Mass. Or, in a similar kind of way, we are intellectual beings. Does God engage human intellects in the church so that the church is involved in the mission of God in a responsible way, so that it is empowered by grace in moments of genuine crisis to say that's the gospel and that isn't. And that decision is made with divine authority. So that my job as a theologian isn't to question Nicaea or Chalcedon, it's to think it through. I mean, what does it mean to say Jesus is fully God and fully man,
right.
unmixed and undivided? But the church makes that decision with a kind of divine authority, an irrevocable authority. The question is now closed for the good of the church. I mean, we don't spend all our time going back and rethinking fundamental questions about is the Logos fully God or not? The Logos incarnate in Jesus, that's settled. That's, again, the notion of the way God engages grace. So one can say those decisions of the early councils of the church, or that matter, councils of Trent on Eucharistic sacrifice or whatever, those decisions are empowered by grace, engaging, elevating, empowering human responsibility. Mm-hmm. So that what I saw as I moved along, say between 2004 and 2010, was every time I came back, I saw more implications mm-hmm. of seeing this kind of Catholic understanding of the way God, in his grace, through Christ and the Spirit, engages the human self as a responsible intellectual being.
Yeah.
Now, I have to admit, at the same time, mainstream Protestantism and the Evangelical Lutheran Church, of which I was a part, was struggling with a set of decisions, particularly on sexuality questions, ordination of people in same-sex relationships. I was definitely on the more traditional side of the question, which lost. What bothered me, I think, wasn't simply that the church made a decision with which I disagreed. It was seeing that even those on the same side I was were hamstrung, it seemed to me, by not having the wider resources of the theological tradition to argue with. Mm-hmm. It just seemed to me if this is all this rather thin kind of arguments were being put forward, this is problematic.
Well, and it brings to the fore just like the principle of authority and decision making there is flawed.
Yeah. And this is, so there was a background. I mean, if you ask me, did I leave the Lutheran Church because of the decisions on sexuality, I would say I would not have left the Lutheran Church without having this other issues of grace decisive. And I probably would have left the Lutheran Church eventually anyway, because my mind and heart had changed. Mm-hmm. But there were, I'll admit, these background contextual issues, which were to me deeply disturbing.
Sure.
It finally reached the point, I mean, as I worked through these questions, mm-hmm. I mean, I was doing ecumenical work. Mm-hmm. A temptation of ecumenism is to think that the grass is greener over the fence. So I was, to some degree, resisting it. You don't want to exaggerate what the other side looks like. They have some of the same internal problems in one's own church body. So I admit, I backpedaled to the degree that I could. But every time I came back to the question, there are perceptions that I couldn't avoid. So people ask me, why did you decide to enter the Catholic Church? And I would say, well, it wasn't really quite a decision. This when you use jargon, it was a discernment. And in fact, I mean, I came to the point where I realized I can't go into a meeting where I'm on the Lutheran side of the discussion, which is implicitly to say that I'm a Lutheran, if I do this anymore, it will cease to be honest.
That's significant. Yeah.
I had just reached a point where at heart, and would say, now this may sound like it's all mind, mm-hmm. but it was also heart to a significant degree. And I just couldn't do it with honesty anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people, and I suppose this irritated me at the time, when I was received in the Catholic Church, there were people who said, well, he was a Catholic all along anyway, to which I would say rather strongly, no, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I know what a high church evangelical Catholic Lutheran was, mm-hmm. and I know what a Roman Catholic is. Mm-hmm. And I was not a Roman Catholic. I was a high church Lutheran of a sort. And when I became a Catholic, I left the Lutheran Church. Yeah. and I think it was really in 2010, late 2009, really, that I'd reached the point where I recognized I was now, had accepted in my mind and in my heart a picture of the Christian life, a Christian of the pursuit of holiness, mm-hmm. the way in which we are called to pursue holiness. I think one thing I would be critical of the Lutheran tradition is that often fell to the wayside.
Mm. Which is one of the implications of those nuanced theological issues.
Precisely.
Yeah.
This is where the notion that one is empowered by grace and you are to seek holiness. This is what goes on with the saints.
Yeah.
This is the importance of the example of the saints, mm-hmm. of people who are moved by grace to a participation in God. One thinks of St. Francis receiving the stigmata.
Right.
I mean, there are enormous diversities in the lives of the saints. Some, the kind of suffering of Francis at the end, other different kinds of lives. But there are ways in which grace engages the human nature we share as responsible and beings with intellect, the way in which grace engages the idiosyncrasies of our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 59 when I became a Catholic.
Right.
It took me a while to get there. Mm-hmm. There was a phrase that was used when I was growing up of going way out of your way to get somewhere. It was going around your elbow to get to your thumb. And I say my coming to the Catholic Church was sort of going around my elbow to get to my thumb. It took a while. Although it was the way I think Providence needed to bring me there.
Yeah. Well, let's actually take a break there and we'll come back and we'll continue from there. But I want to dig a little bit more into precisely this this discernment and coming to really the practical implications of what was being discussed there. So we'll be back in just a couple minutes, so stay tuned to hear the rest of Dr. Michael Root's story. I want to remind you that if you are a convert to the Catholic Church, we invite you to connect with the Coming Home Network International. We are a network of converts sharing our stories, but also helping others discover the truth and beauty and helping them in their own discernment, their own prayer, especially through encouragement and fellowship. And so check that out at chnetwork.org and join our newsletter there. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Michael's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Dr. Michael Root. He's a former Lutheran. He came to the church in 2010, and he's the Professor Emeritus of Systematic Theology at the Catholic University of America. Michael, when we left off, you know, you were talking about finally this long process, and you characterize it not ultimately as a singular decision, but this discernment, this process of eventually becoming Catholic. But when we left off, you were talking, I find it very fascinating, talking sort of about grappling personally with really the practical implications of those big theological questions that you'd wrestle with. Grace, justification, kind of the interaction of grace and man's free will, how that all works out in theory, but then the actual practice of that and how it plays out in the actual living of the Christian life. That's something you were discovering or coming to appreciate in a deeper way. Let's pick it up there and share a bit more of that discernment and discovery.
Yeah. I think there's partially because I see in my own life the way in which one, to a secular eye, it might look like accidents, but I think looking back now, it looks like providence. I mean, that I landed in a dorm with religion majors, that I fell in with certain guys, that I met people at certain times. I was asked to write a certain essay on a certain topic at a certain moment. The way in which we're called as Christians and Catholics, doing a kind of personal initiative in seeking holiness, but also being open to the ways in which things come to us from the outside, we don't expect, we didn't choose, that we encounter, and there may be gifts shaping us, bringing us into greater conformity to Christ. So there was some advice I got at the time I was thinking of becoming a Catholic and when I was received. I find reading the daily office quite significant in unity with the church, the readings from the saints each day in the office of readings, and have that form you. Luckily, there were a number of other Lutherans I knew, good friends who had become Catholic before me, and I received some very good advice. One of which was not to think that the day you're received in the Catholic Church is over. You're there, you're a Catholic, over, done, sealed.
Right.
There's a kind of ongoing formation that you have to be open to. I mean, and some of our talking about agency and responsibility, but that's also being open to let other things form you, which is a kind of agency of reading, for me, reading the daily office, reading the lives of the saints, and allowing that to shape me. In ways that you don't see until looking back afterwards. It was only after I'd been Catholic a few years I realized I was in the Catholic Church where they didn't have a tabernacle behind the altar. And I realized, actually, without my thinking about it, I think my piety when I would come into church has become focusing on praying, thinking about the Blessed Host there behind the altar, which was a way of participating in the life of the church with being open to let it shape who you are, because there is an engagement of your seeking holiness and the gifts of grace is in the church, and you have to allow the two to interact, so to speak. Right. It's not all about me, nor is it that I just wait and let grace act on me. There's a kind of ongoing engagement in which you trust that providence is bringing together the gifts of the church that you need, that I need, and my reaching out, so to speak, so that by attending Mass, being open to what's going on, reading Catholic devotional literature, reshaped my attitude. I think in the Mass, it was important to me during COVID. In the Archdiocese of Washington, we had no choice. About 4 months, you couldn't go to church. The churches were shut down in the District of Columbia. And I would, quote unquote, attend Mass online. Mm-hmm. I couldn't receive. That was a certain drop in meaning, you might want to say. But the notion of the sacrifice of the Mass, I could, in prayer, offer Christ present in this Mass to God. Mm-hmm. In some sense, the sacrifice of the Mass became very important to me in COVID. It's one thing I could do in my prayer as I watch from a distance at my parish or the cathedral downtown, whatever Mass I was looking at online. So one needs to be open to the ways in which one seeks what devotions are meaningful and appropriate. For me, particularly, I would say the daily office means a great deal. I know others, daily rosary, whatever. There are enormous riches in the Catholic tradition. Mm-hmm. But one sees the combination of personal responsibility while noting you have to let providence lead you in quite sometimes ways you don't expect.
Right. With those theological, definitions and nuances about grace and nature and all that, right? Even if you have, the most accurate view of all that, ultimately the Christian life is this experiential sort of working out the exact dynamic. Because even with prayer, I was thinking, putting me in mind of the journey of prayer, right? In the Catechism, talking about the different expressions of prayer, vocal prayer, meditative prayer, contemplative prayer.
Right.
And part of what it's describing is there's this journey of even recognizing that, like, in prayer, we start on this human level of speaking to God, doing something very active. But in the end, it's moving toward this place, we want to describe it as this, it's a more intense activity, but the activity is of being open.
Right.
Because ultimately, the deepest prayer is not what I say, but receiving.
Right.
But that dynamic, you can describe it all you want, but ultimately you have to kind of wrestle through it as a Christian.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's, there is a kind of looking forward to the kingdom of heaven. Mm-hmm. Augustine says that, I mean, people sometimes ask me, because I teach courses on eschatology. I mean, what will I do? I mean, what's doing? What's the activity? And Augustine says, well, it's an activity that's perfect rest and a rest that's perfect activity. Hmm. That the distinction between active and passive, in a sense, not all senses, in a sense, ends. And certainly in the Christian, if one thinks of the Christian life as a foretaste of the perfection of the kingdom of God, and I think it's an important way to think about the Christian life.
Yeah.
Then there is a way in which one should be moving toward the point at which rest and activity, my being an agent and my letting myself being acted upon, move together. And I think the Catholic life in particular seeks a kind of unity of being open to formation, which is an action, and being formed by the riches of the Mass, adoration, quite different forms of prayer, the lessons of the lives of the saints, those things all come together.
I feel like the practice of keeping the Sabbath holy is an important piece of this, right? Because, young husband and father here, right? It sounds great in theory to keep the Sabbath, restful and leisurely, whatever. We recognize it, like the dynamics there are complicated. But what does it really mean to rest in God on the Sabbath? What is putting aside of servile labor look like? And I feel like I get the best vision of it just in watching my kids play. Like little kids, play and work, there's no distinction,
right?
When they're out there working and they're building something, whatever, the distinction is almost gone. There's a perfect leisure, a perfect contentment and trust, but also an intensity. And so like that collapse between what we experience as rest and work sort of collapses when we're living in that sort of, that certain way. And we're called to practice that on the Sabbath day.
Yes, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I will admit, often on Sunday afternoon, this will sound, this may scandalize some people. I mean, I smoke a cigar, and I read something, usually philosophy, that's not work.
Yeah.
It's not an article I'm writing.
Yeah.
But I enjoy a good cigar, and to sit outside, probably a warm day, with a, I sit on a bench in front of our apartment building where it's permitted, and smoke a cigar and read philosophy or theology, to me, is an activity which is restful.
Yeah.
And at times, perhaps, in reading theology, one moves beyond simply conceptual, a conceptual activity to being formed by the gifts that are given.
Yeah, I feel like another journey that Christians experience as part of it is when we first take the Christian life more seriously. As you know, it has duties and obligations. It's something we do have to work at. We respond to God. We take prayer more seriously, and that's good. But then at a certain point, or at certain points, that prayer almost becomes work because we're beginning to think of it too much in the active sense of, oh, it's a task I have to do. When ultimately, the deeper layer of that is recognizing, you know, prayer is not something I have to do, it's something I get to do. It's not something I check off the list as the most important, but it's where I go to discover God. And He is the gift. It's not His effects, it's God Himself.
Right.
Yeah.
What I find is that you do not always know when God is leading you. For me, it's important that on days in which it is something I just find, you know, I read morning prayer every morning. I try and do the Office of Readings. It is a task, but I try and do it. Even when it isn't, because I don't know when the formation, so to speak, is occurring.
Right.
I mean, this is an important point about many cases of the lives of the saints, that the trust that grace is shaping you. And there are the days when you feel it, and the days when you don't.
Right.
But it doesn't always mean the days when you feel it is the days when grace is operative, and the days when you don't are the days it isn't. So there is a kind of rhythm of spiritual fulfillment and spiritual dryness. Spiritual dryness is also an experience of the saints.
Yeah.
What's foundational, it seems to me, is a kind of trust. Here, of grace is not just a quantity or an attitude of God's, but the way in which God is engaging persons in ways they may not understand and leading them forward. There's a striking passage at the very end of the Joseph story, Genesis 50, where the brothers of Joseph, Jacob has died, and the brothers now think, uh-oh, Joseph didn't give us payback while Dad was alive, but Dad's died, and we're now going to get the payback. And Joseph says, No. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, which is a striking passage. In the Abraham stories, God is always intervening and doing things. I mean, destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, bargaining with Abraham, blah, blah, blah. In the Joseph story, God almost never intervenes. But we're told at the end, although God has not intervened in decisive ways like destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, in fact, God was at work providentially in the whole thing.
Right.
So that you can say at the end, Joseph can say at the end, God, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And so I think for me, an important part of the of daily Christian life is being open and also willing to sometimes go through periods of your life where there is a kind of spiritual dryness, where it does feel perhaps a bit like work. Right. That may be the time when you're called upon to die with Christ a bit.
Right.
I mean, we are to die and rise with Christ daily, but that doesn't mean the dying and the rising every day is the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one thing we haven't talked about. I mean, I think it is important to try and think of grace as being conformed to Christ, which means being conformed to his death and resurrection.
Yeah.
And that means a kind of activity and passivity. Mm-hmm. But you don't know when it's going on.
Right.
One thing I would say, I mean, after my rather meandering path through the Catholic Church, is a certain kind of trust that, granted, things may meander. Sometimes God writes straight with crooked lines, Kant said. But a kind of underlying trust. And that's part of a belief in the priority of grace. Grace mm-hmm. will get you there.
Yeah.
You are to seek it. There is an activity that is called for, but grace is the one that does the leading.
Yeah. And your response only comes one moment at a time, one decision at a time.
Right.
And that's part of the humility of that, is that just not over-exaggerating in your own mind your role. No, it's one decision at a time.
Right. This is Newman's Lead Kindly Light. I ask only light enough for one step.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, that's what you ask for, and that's hopefully what you get. But you trust for the larger picture in leading you on. I mean, when I reached the perception late 2009, beginning of 2010, that I really had no choice. I simply could not. I had simply changed in heart and mind. I didn't know where it would take me.
Yeah.
I was teaching at a Lutheran seminary. I was already semi-retired. That could have kept up, but it was still, it was awkward at the very least. Mm-hmm. But now I was unusually thankful to God. I was able to get a position at Catholic University. But this is a real question of, particularly for those who are working for the church and thinking of becoming Catholic, I mean, there are questions, difficult questions. It was easier for me in a certain sense. I was at the end of, I was already 59. I was already at a point where I could semi-retire. But trust becomes, I mean, trust becomes a kind of expression of the virtue of hope. And we talk about faith and love a lot, but we don't talk a heck of a lot about hope.
Right.
It's the sort of forgotten one. And Aquinas is very interesting here. We hope in God in two ways. God is what we hope for, because we hope for the vision of God and the beatific vision.
Right.
But God is also what we hope will get us there. We hope for the God we will see, and we hope for Deus ad juvans, the God who helps, so that I will reach the kingdom. Is not a trust in my own power, but it is a trust in God getting me there. And so an issue in the Christian life, this again gets back to this sort of paradox of activity and being activity as a kind of openness to being led. It's taking the step. You have to take the steps. So you stand there stock still. No one's going to step for you. But being open to being led, I mean, that has to be rooted in the virtue of hope, which is a double hope. Hope in God is your goal, and hope in God is the means to get to the goal. And that's the virtue of hope.
Yeah.
Even when all you can, the most it seems you get any day is enough light for the next step.
Yeah. Again, it just seems so significant. Take this back to God revealing himself as Father. Like there's a world of difference between a slave trying to earn something versus a child who is secure in the love of the Father, and whose Father wants him to grow up, gives him every encouragement, but still needs him to, asks him to take that next step.
Right.
Those two situations are entirely different, right? But that is the image that's revealed to us, that God is a loving Father, and that we, through Christ, we are.
Right, and Jesus says, you are now friends.
Right.
Yeah, you are now friends. The friendship with God is one of the images Aquinas uses strongly for our relation with God.
Mm-hmm.
And that the relation to God as Father, Jesus as friend or brother, with us, leading us all, and the Holy Spirit within us, that Trinitarian picture, so that one understands grace in that context of the Father who calls us on and leads us, Jesus who is with us, the Spirit that's within us, all three empowering us in that movement toward finally the kingdom of God.
Right. Well, we've got about 5 minutes left. And so, you entered the church 2010. Where and when did that actually occur?
St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Columbia, South Carolina on August the 11th.
Okay.
Feast of St. Clair.
Beautiful. All right. And then, since then, what have share some of the work that you've been involved in, some of the...
I did. I went to Catholic University. Yeah. I taught courses in eschatology, that is, last things, heaven, hell, purgatory, death. I give talks often to Catholic student groups on eschatological subjects. Okay. I find students often have never heard any Catholic talk about purgatory. Mm-hmm. So I do that on occasion. I did that last week at the University of Florida.
It's another great example of a nuanced theological issue that, again, really bears on the practical experience of sanctification.
And there is, I think, again, this is on Loyola College, Maryland. Yeah. They have a poster, theology, the only major that counts when you're dead. but I worked on theological topics. Mm-hmm. This was unusual. I went back on the American Lutheran Catholic Dialogue on the Catholic side. Mm-hmm. I was a little reluctant to do that, mm-hmm. although I found out that the Lutherans were ones who had suggested perhaps I would be a good person on the Catholic side. Mm-hmm. I believe I am the only person in the modern ecumenical movement to have served on both sides of the same dialogue. But ecumenical work to that degree, I mean, I don't do anything as much as I used to, but I've done some of that. I am trying to get writing done, although that comes to me slowly. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to get work done on grace and final judgment. Final judgment gets strikingly small amounts of attention in contemporary theology. Mm. But if you read the New Testament, it's everywhere.
Right.
And there really are complicated questions. I was reading the debates of the Council of Trent on grace and justification, and there was a brilliant passage by Diego Lainez, one of the very first Jesuits, the second general. He's followed Ignatius Loyola as the general of the Jesuits. There's never any connection between judgment and forgiveness. Final judgment doesn't involve forgiveness in the New Testament. I mean, you'll be judged by what you did. How do we put together judgment, forgiveness, grace, and mercy, and grace? Grace, mercy, forgiveness, judgment. That's what I'm trying to understand. It's a complicated set of questions. I think it gets at really fundamental questions about the Christian life.
Yeah.
Whether I can get a book out of that, I don't know. but I'm now fully retired. I am very slow worker. I'm a writer of essays, not of books. but I keep busy.
Very good. Well, we'll keep praying for that writing and your continued journey there as you in your retirement. But with just a couple minutes left, again, if there's somebody, let's for those who might be on a similar journey to what you were, I think particular, like maybe in some of these weird places in terms of dialogue or ecumenism, or again, trying to again wrestle with these distinctions and this division in the church. What's a word of encouragement you give to them to the continuing journey and dealing with that?
I think the primary word I think would be, in a certain sense, keep at it.
Yeah.
Don't say I'm afraid to think about that. I won't. You have to be able to think about it as clearly and honestly as you can. Now, I recognize that many pastors, former students of mine that I've talked to, are in difficult situations sometimes. You don't see how you're going to put food on the table for your kids. What will you do when you cease to be a pastor if you become a Catholic? Those are real questions, and I don't, they have to be faced. Mm-hmm. The answers for different people are going to be complicated, mm-hmm. but the crucial question is to take that, continue to work on the issues with trust in God.
Yeah.
That you trust that grace will lead you. We are called to take up our cross, and those crosses can sometimes be far more difficult than any I've had to bear. Mm-hmm. But the cross leads to resurrection. We are to then persevere in seeking God. Yeah. And that's what we are empowered by grace to do, to persevere in that seeking. It may lead different kinds of ways. It leads people different places. But that's what I think grace grace will allow us, empower us to do.
Yeah. So good. Well, thanks so much for sharing your story, Michael, and for your work. And thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Dr. Michael Root's story was inspiration to you. Like a great word at the end there about this necessity of perseverance. And again, as Michael talked about earlier, hope, right? Not just in hope in terms of the end of the story, but hope that God, moment by moment, gives us the grace. He will. He is the helper. He will see us through. But sometimes we just have to keep in mind that it's the grace for the next decision, right? The grace is sufficient for today, for this decision, for this issue that I'm facing. Don't get out ahead of the Holy Spirit. Right here, right now, God is with you, and He's calling you, and He's giving you the grace to take the next step forward. So let's keep praying for each other. Again, we remain on the journey. We'll be back again next week with another story. In the meantime, God bless.